This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
It's a right guaranteed not once, but twice in our Constitution. A trial by jury. And many of us are asked to serve on them, whether we want to or not. For some, getting a jury summons in the mail brings to mind scenes from courtroom dramas and popular culture, like the 1957 film 12 Angry Men.
I gave you my arguments.
We're not convinced. We want to hear them again. We have as much time as it takes.
Everything, every single thing that took place in that courtroom, but I mean everything, says he's guilty.
For others, jury duty is a chore to get out of any way you can. Remember when Tina Fey's character in 30 Rock showed up dressed like Princess Leia, for instance?
Excuse me, Imperial Guard, how long do these arson trials typically last?
A couple weeks, probably? You can drop the voice.
Oh, this used to get me out of jury duty in Chicago all the time.
Whether jury duty is a responsibility you dread or relish, the trial of former President Trump in Manhattan put the spotlight on the jury selection process, one that happens in courthouses across the country. Today, we speak with legal experts about the role juries play in our justice system and the psychology of jury selection. But first, after the break, we hear from someone who served on a jury for another high-profile case. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. Stay with us. We've got a lot to get to.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Joining us from New York is Philip Bump. He's a national columnist for The Washington Post. In 2009, he served as a juror in the Astor trial. Philip, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the Astor trial, or People of the State of New York v. Anthony Marshall and Francis Morrissey, was this very high-profile criminal case. The son of philanthropist Brooke Astor was accused of stealing millions of dollars from her during the final years of her life. What do you remember about the selection process for that trial?
It was fascinating. I was doing consulting work at the time and just had a job complete, and so I didn't really have a lot on my plate. I got this jury summons and went in. My wife had recently had jury duty, and I was very enthusiastic about it. I'm one of these nerds that's very excited about civics and so on and so forth. So I was very excited, and I went in, and I remember sitting in this very institutional room, if you will, in an old building down in Lower Manhattan, and there was at some point a question posed. Who might be able to be on a jury that could last for a month or two, and I was able to do so. And so I raised my hand, and that sort of kicked it off. And we went through a process that was remarkably similar to the one that we saw in Manhattan earlier this month with the Trump trial.
Do you know why you were selected? Did you get a sense of why they thought you would be a good choice?
Yeah, I mean, I say this with all due humility, but I was told at the time that they were looking for people who had some sense of the complexities of the case. We obviously didn't know what it was that the case was about until the arguments were presented to us. We were weeded out so that we didn't have preconceived notions about the case. But they told us that they were looking for people who had some background in something that indicated that we would be able to follow. I mean, it was a complex case involving, wills and codicils to wills and institutional donations to charities in New York City. I mean, there's a lot to it, and they just wanted to make sure they had people that were able to track the case. I know that sounds sort of self-promoting, but that's what we were told.
Going into it, how did you view your responsibility as a juror?
I mean, very seriously, right? The nice thing about the case from my standpoint was that I legitimately didn't know anything about it. I knew the Astor name. I had heard the name Brooke Astor. I didn't know that's the case for which I was being selected, and I didn't know a whole lot about it. And, you know, I approached it in the way that one would hope a juror would, I believe, which is that you kept an open mind and you looked at the evidence that was presented to you in court. And I had the benefit of not having had any preconceived notions when I went in.
As you think about the process, what did you not understand about what it meant to be a juror until after you went through that experience?
I mean, I think one of there were a number of revelatory moments over the course. And this, you know, this lasted months. I mean, they said who could be on it for a month or two, and ended up lasting 5 or 6 months from basically April to October of 2009. There were a number of revelatory points. One was that, you know, this probably should have been obvious to me coming in, but your task there as a juror is not to look at the defendant and say, I think he committed a crime. It is instead to say, you know, here's the evidence that I have available, and here's the letter of the law, which I think is a nuance that's missed, that you're not just, you know, judging guilt, you're judging specifically to the statutes that are at issue. And that was not sort of my expectation coming in. I just sort of thought you were presented and you say, oh, you know, guilty or not guilty. But, it's almost technical. It's almost mathematical. You know, does this add up to the letter of the law? The other big revelatory moment was when we got into deliberations, and I realized that the other 11 people had a different take than I did. You know, I went into it and was like, oh, I see all the evidence, and I assume everyone has the same conclusions that I do. And that obviously is very much not the case.
Well, Anthony Marshall was convicted in 2009 on charges that he defrauded his mother out of tens of millions of dollars. And as you said, Philip, the trial took close to 6 months. How did your life change? That's a long time to serve on a jury.
It is. And, you know, we made, I think it was like $40 a day. After 3 weeks, it jumped up to $49 a day. So it was a real boost in the income there. But, you know, from the standpoint of just getting by, it was difficult. It was challenging. I didn't have an external employer who was paying me. It was also just weird because my wife, knew what case I was on, and she was tracking the news. And, you know, there'd be times I'd come home after a particularly interesting to the outside world witness, and she'd sort of be looking at me expectantly, trying to read my face to get a sense of how things had gone, which I was used to, because in the courtroom, the same thing happened. The defendants and the lawyers all scrutinize you over the course of the trial to try and sense how you're perceiving things. But it's just odd to have a job that you spend all day and then you get home and you literally can't talk to your spouse about it. It's unusual. Once the trial was over, we spent a lot of time sort of debriefing what each of us had experienced.
We're talking to Philip Bump. He served as a juror in the 2009 trial of Anthony Marshall. Marshall was found guilty of defrauding his elderly mother, Brooke Astor, out of millions of dollars. We're also hearing from you. One of you texted, I've gotten several summons over the years. It feels like an annoyance, but I know it's important. I was chosen as a juror for the first time recently in a civil trial in Houston. The judge and his staff were so kind and professional to the jurors, I was kind of blown away. The deliberation process was intense, but I was proud of the verdict we came to. It was an experience I'll remember. And another of you shares this. Being from Kentucky, I was thrilled to serve on a 3-week trial involving a dispute between partners in a horse racing business. I find the whole process fascinating. Jury selection, opening and closing arguments, evidence allowed and not allowed, deliberation, and people watching. Thanks for those messages. Hey, Philip, more broadly, how did serving on a jury change the way you think about our justice system?
It really did make me more attuned to, the difficult role that jurors play. I mentioned earlier that comparison between the statute and the evidence, which I think is nuance a lot of people miss. But then secondarily, that just gave me a better sense of how difficult it is to have those two things line up, right? You know, we distill the process of adjudicating people's guilt in these things through the lens of, you know, public opinion often. You know, we look at it and we say, yes, I think he did this right. You know, I think she didn't do this. And this gave me a much better sense of I am less likely to jump to conclusions about how juries did well or did poorly because I am not privy to the restrictions that they are in terms of the evidence that they have. I did not study the letter of the law in the way that they did or, you know, were presented to, you were able to ask the judge questions about the letter of the law. It made me much more cautious about assuming that someone got it right or wrong because you're simply not in that room and under the same conditions that they are.
Now, this case received a lot of media attention at the time. What was it like serving on a jury for such a high-profile case?
Honestly, you didn't get a sense as a juror that there was a whole lot of attention being paid to it, right? Because we didn't track the news. We didn't read about what was happening. You know, we found out, for example, that the foreperson on our case had been attacked on the subway from her in the room. And we're like, oh my gosh, that's terrible. Later to find out that it was a big story in the New York Post, right? Like, we didn't see ourselves in that way. The moment at which, you know, obviously we had a lot of high-profile witnesses. Henry Kissinger came to testify, Ned DeLaRenta came to testify. You know, there were a lot of, we knew from that standpoint that there was a significance to it. The moment at which I realized that this was something a lot of people were tracking was after we had given our verdict and we walked out of the building, and then for the first time reporters were able to speak with us and they knew all of our names and were asking us very specific questions about what we'd done. It's a very weird experience if you're not used to, you know, having anyone know who you are, to walk out of a building and have that phalanx of reporters just saying, hey, Mr. Bump. That was the moment which was like, oh, this gives me a sense of the scale. And then when I got home and there was a reporter from the Times waiting to talk to me at my door, that obviously added to it.
I mean, with that context, how are you thinking about what might be on the minds of jurors who are serving in Trump's case in Manhattan?
Yeah, I'm really, obviously the two aren't comparable. I mean, the scale of this case is so much larger than one we went through, which seemed very big at the time. I'm deeply, deeply empathetic with what they're going through. It's a very difficult thing to have to exclude news, to exclude any sort of mention of this very, very high-profile case, to not be able to talk to anyone about it. And then, of course, they have this added layer of there is a real risk to them being known as members of this jury, right? We didn't have that. I mean, there was, you know, I didn't need to worry about it. I wasn't telegraphic that I was a member of this jury, but they have to worry about that. So it is a very, very difficult task in the best of circumstances, and they are under particularly challenging circumstances as well.
That's Philip Bump. He's a national columnist at The Washington Post. He served as a juror in the 2000 case known as the Astor trial. Philip, thanks for speaking with us.
Of course.
Coming up, how are juries selected, and can we ensure they're impartial? We'll get to that after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
We're discussing jury duty. The criminal trial of former President Trump put the jury selection process in the spotlight, but every day, juries are seated in courthouses across the U.S. Joining us in studio is veteran trial consultant Leslie Ellis. She holds a doctorate in social psychology and is the founder of the CISA Group. That's a litigation consulting firm. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Tampa, Florida is Jeff Schwartz. He's a professor of law at Cooley Law School and a former judge with the Miami-Dade County Court. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And with us from Newton, Massachusetts is Ron Sullivan. He's director of the Criminal Justice Institute at Harvard Law School, where he's also a professor. Ron, welcome to 1A.
Good morning.
Ron, just explain, how central are juries to our legal system?
They're absolutely central to our legal system. So we have a system where we believe that we can be judged by a jury of our peers, and that that's the best system in the world in order to adjudicate guilt or innocence in the criminal context, or whether to or how to apportion financial responsibility in the civil context. So it has worked well, and consistent with your call or your writer's email or text, there's an old saying that our system of justice is the worst in the world, except for all the others. And that's probably true. And the point here is that it has its issues here and there, but net-net, it does a pretty good job at getting to the truth.
Jeff, how are jurors typically summoned?
Well, jurors are typically summoned to come to the courthouse either by way of the fact that they have a driver's license, or some are taken off of the voter registration rolls. In the state of Florida, we used to use voter registration rolls, but now we use the driver's license. You have a driver's license, you're going to get a summons sooner or later. That's how they end up coming to the courthouse.
Have you ever been summoned either while working as a judge or as a professor?
Surprisingly, I never got summoned until about a month after I got elected as a judge and just before I took office. And of course, at that point, there's no way I'm going to be on a jury. And now, even if I got a summons, there's no way a judge is going to let a former judge be on a jury.
Ron, what types of cases get juries?
So for criminal cases, juries are required for felony cases. So you have felony cases versus misdemeanor cases. And in most jurisdictions, the felony case is triggered by potential prison exposure of more than 6 months. That tends to elevate cases from a misdemeanor to a jury. So for those cases, you get a jury, and that's required by the Constitution. In civil cases, it varies from state to state in terms of whether they're jury eligible and the number of jurors. But in very many civil cases, these are cases for money damages, one will have a jury as well.
Now, Leslie, you've worked as a trial consultant for more than two decades. How are trial consultants used in jury cases?
So jury consultants can be used in a lot of different ways in jury cases, and we can be retained anywhere from before a civil case is even filed or when an indictment is expected, all the way through the end of trial. Specific to jury selection, we work with our clients to help develop a profile of who we think are good, but more importantly, bad jurors are going to be. Which types of people do we think are going to be most biased against our case? We can help our clients draft voir dire questions, either to submit to the judge or to ask themselves. We help with drafting juror questionnaires for jurors to complete in advance of the trial, and then we can be there during jury selection to advise on follow-up, and then sort of the ultimate end of jury selection is who should be struck with peremptory challenges, so we can help our clients make those decisions as well.
Now, we've heard that term voir dire quite a bit in recent weeks. Just define that for us.
Sure. Jury selection is the whole process of jury selection. Voir dire is Latin for to speak the truth, and that generally refers to the process of questioning jurors during the process of jury selection.
Now, jurors are supposed to be impartial, mm-hmm. but what other qualities are you looking for?
Well, impartiality really is the what we're looking for. So that's the most important thing we're looking for. Something else that we're also focused on in jury selection is leadership skills. Really, when we're trying to decide who we might want to strike with those peremptory challenges, there are people who may or may not be the most open to our clients' cases, but the ones we're the most worried about are the ones who are likely to take a leadership role during deliberations, build consensus, very likable people, can bring people along with them. They are more, quote-unquote, dangerous than those who are quieter, more likely to go along with the group.
Jeff, what role do judges play during voir dire?
Well, it depends on whether you're in federal court or many state courts. In federal court, it's very rare that lawyers really get to ask very many questions, if any at all. Mostly they have to submit their questions in writing, and the judge does all of the questioning. There may be some follow-up questions that are requested at a sidebar, and the judge, in fact, will ask those questions. In state courts, like in Florida, for example, and I practice in Ohio also, the lawyers do most of the questioning. A judge will ask some basic questions about the jurors and then turn it over first to the prosecutor and then or the plaintiff and then to the defendant to ask follow-up questions and to ask questions that are important to them to determine whether they have any preconceived notions, whether they know any of the witnesses. There's a lot of reasons why they would ask, try to get their attitudes on things by asking questions like, what kind of magazines do you read? What television programs do you watch? And then they try to formulate a thought process of what kind of juror they want and whether those people fit that. So it really does depend on what court you're in, whether it's federal or state courts. That's just kind of the way it works.
Ron, you worked as a public defender in D.C. You've selected more than 100 juries for trial. When you were going through that process, were there certain characteristics that you kept an eye out for in a potential jury?
Indeed, but it really was dependent on the type of case. So by way of example, if there was a case where we had a very technical defense, I might look for a juror who has some sort of technical background because that juror may be able to understand. So if I had a complicated DNA case in a homicide, then while in the normal course I would not prefer a biochemist on my jury, if one were there, then that might be someone I'd look to, or an engineer or someone who has some sort of technical background. It really, really depends on the type of case. And depending on the type of case, that's the sort of juror that you're looking for. Now, I agree wholeheartedly with what the jury consultant said earlier. As a baseline, you want someone who you think will be fair, impartial, and follow the instructions. However, beyond that, each side is looking for a juror who they think is more disposed to their side of the case than the other case, and that is very much case-dependent.
Jeff, I'm sure during your time on the bench, you probably heard quite a few excuses for people to try to get out of jury duty. Yeah. How did you either respond to those excuses? What did you tell people?
There are some people who honestly have a problem with the idea of judging other people's actions, and those are the religious or moral objections. And those are the kind of people that obviously are excused almost immediately when they state that. Then there's always the one who doesn't want to be there. And it's a criminal case. And this has happened where they say, well, I don't think I can be fair because I think he's guilty or he wouldn't be sitting here. And the minute someone says something like that, I don't excuse them. And I have on occasion when they become very insistent upon it, that they're overplaying it. I said, okay, you're not going to be on the jury, but you're going to sit in the back of the courtroom and you're going to listen to this whole case and you will report every morning. I want them to understand and carry with them the message that we need jurors. And I'm sorry you're busy, but everybody's busy. And this is something that is part of being a citizen in this country, and that is sitting on juries. So you really have to take you have to look at attitude. You have to look at the way that they're you look at body language. You look at a lot of things to see if they're really being serious about it. Now, people have unchangeable plans like vacations or medical treatment or things like that. Then you have to let them go and they'll just get re-noticed for another time. So you really have to be very careful about how you do this. But you have to walk in there with an understanding that there's a duty that you're performing and you really need to stay and do that duty.
And briefly, what happens if someone is summoned but they don't show up?
That depends on the jurisdiction. In federal court, a lot of times they will get a notice from the judge on a rule to show cause. Why weren't you here? They are subject to contempt of court for failure to obey the summons. It's pretty much that way in every state. But most of the time in state courts, they just don't want to push that button. They'll just re-notice them for another time. If they're repeat offenders, then it's a different story. Then you have to bring them in and explain the facts of life to them.
Let's take a quick pause here. Still to come, ever wonder why you haven't been chosen for duty? We explore the psychology of jury selection in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
Now back to jury duty. U.S. citizens have a right to a trial by a jury of their peers, but that right has not been granted equally. Black Americans in the South were frequently excluded from juries. That led to the case Norris v. Alabama in 1935. The court ruled that the exclusion of African Americans from jury service violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The case originated in Alabama. Nine African American teenagers, known as the Scottsboro Nine, had been falsely accused of raping two white women in 1931. The jury in that Alabama trial has no African-American members. Eight of the teenagers were sentenced to death. The Supreme Court was able to reverse the conviction of one of the young men, Clarence Norris, because of jury discrimination. Ron, what have been some of the more recent Supreme Court rulings related to the racial composition of juries?
Well, Batson v. Kentucky probably was the most significant case to follow Norris, and that has to do with the exercise of peremptory strikes. So Norris had to do with the jury pool, whether you could systematically exclude blacks from the jury pool. Batson says, well, once they're in the pool, you can't just get rid of them by exercising peremptory challenges. So Batson's progeny has gone on to say that just as you cannot exclude people from using peremptory strikes based on race, you cannot do it based on gender and sexual orientation either. So these are all safeguards to help ensure that it is, in fact, a representative sample.
Leslie, when you're advising clients, how do you advise them with that context to help them avoid breaking the law?
Sure, sure. There are a lot of stereotypes around jurors and demographics and which demographics would make a quote-unquote good or bad juror. What we know from the research is that there's very little relationship between demographics and verdict preferences and or how they'll see the evidence. The real issue is experiences, attitudes, beliefs, and those affect how people view and evaluate and weigh evidence. So when I talk to clients about this, what I say is not only should you not base jury selection decisions and peremptory challenge decisions based on race or gender because it's unconstitutional, you shouldn't do it because it's just a bad use of a strike. You should be, if we get enough information during jury selection, which is another issue, we should be looking more importantly at those case-relevant attitudes and experiences and world beliefs that are more likely to have an impact on whether a juror is going to be biased for or against a party.
And yet, Ron, we do see across Supreme Court cases this issue being raised about the racial composition of juries. So if the research says, well, demographics isn't a good way to decide or figure out how a jury is going to decide a case, why hasn't it been important to address this issue of racial bias on juries?
Well, that's a very complicated question and a very complicated issue. So a couple things, and several states have made strides to try to remedy the following. But what we found over the years is that the jury, the mechanisms that states use in order to draw jurors to the pool were underrepresentative. Maybe voter rolls, for example, would disproportionately favor some races as opposed to others because some people registered to vote with more frequency than others. So you didn't draw as much from the pool. So states that do a good job will use all sorts of inputs in order to bring people onto the jury pool, voter registration, driver's licenses, ID cards for libraries. I mean, just tax records for home ownership. I mean, all sorts of places to draw. So that's one way to help.
A member of our text club writes, one time I got as far as being in the jury pool. I asked how the defendant would get a fair trial if none of us on the jury were people of color. The defendant was Hispanic. I was immediately removed. My question was not answered. Jury pools often come from voter rolls or DMV records, as we discussed. That can skew jury pools to people who remain at one address for a longer time. Those citizens tend to be more white. Additionally, according to a 2023 Gallup poll, about 40% of Black Americans say they are likely to be treated unfairly by police compared to less than 20% of white Americans. And admitting to a negative experience with law enforcement can keep someone from being selected as a juror. Ron, how do you ensure that juries reflect their communities?
That's tough. So when people hear that a jury is supposed to be a jury of one's peers, that does not literally mean that there is a sort of a numeric representation that is consistent with who the defendant or defendants are. What that means is that it's drawn from the community in which the person lives. So it is tough. There are structural reasons that explain it as well. That is to say that, that is to say that many Black and brown people cannot afford to sit on jury. So I have a trial coming up in May. It's going to be a 6-week trial. I'm not optimistic that I'm going to get a lot of Black or brown people on that jury. One of the reasons is that you have to have a job that pays you in order to serve on a jury. Many people do not have jobs that pay, and they simply can't pay their mortgage or their rent or their light bill if they sit on a jury for 4, 5, 6 weeks. So that skews a jury in a certain direction already. So one of the things we have to do is make jury service affordable. What jurisdictions pay, it varies from state to state, but it's basically enough to, you know, pay your parking fees and get a sandwich for lunch. But it doesn't make up for what you lose. So with minority candidates on a jury, it's usually people who have state jobs because states are required by law to pay their employees when they get jury service, or folks who tend to have some other income that allows them to spend time on a jury. So that's a tough one. It's structural. It's extrajudicial, meaning that the solutions have to come outside of the judiciary as well as making some changes inside of the judiciary.
Leslie?
One other thing that I think is helpful or will be helpful is, as Ron said, Batson has been around since 1986. It hasn't been terribly effective. It's difficult to implement the steps that are required. What some states have started to do just in the last few years is change the way their state Batson procedures happen. And so they're making it easier for a litigant, for an attorney, to make a Batson challenge, meaning to say that the other party has struck somebody based on race or gender or sexual orientation, and lowered the burden to try to prove to the court and for the court to rule that juror's constitutional right has been violated. So people are trying to make Batson a little bit easier to implement. That is, as Ron said, sort of one of the few tools that you actually have in the courtroom.
Jeff, as a judge, were you able to intervene in the jury selection process if you felt one side or the other was skirting close to violating the rules?
Yeah, but that normally comes up in the context of an objection to, at least in what we've set up under our, what we call the Neal and Slappy cases in the state of Florida, that if in fact someone is striking, for example, all of the African Americans off the jury, and it's an African American defendant, the defense attorney is going to stand up and say, after one of them, and then you get to the second one, Judge, we want a race-neutral reason why this prosecutor is striking African-Americans off the jury. If that reason isn't really palatable to the judge, then the judge can say, I am denying your peremptory challenge. You can use, if you really have a reason that you don't like this juror, then you can use one of your challenges for cause. And it's our way of kind of regulating that. It doesn't matter what the minority might be or the class of person that we're talking about, that they're striking, whether it has to do with gender or it has to do with sexual preference. It doesn't really matter. If, in fact, that's happening, then the judge has the right upon the objection of the opposing counsel to say, no, you're not, I'm not going to let you exercise a peremptory here.
Leslie, what types of group dynamics emerge during jury deliberations?
Oh, group dynamics are a lot of fun to watch, particularly among juries. So there's a lot of research that shows the way the majority feels at the beginning of deliberation, so the majority of the individual verdict preferences, tends to be what the outcome is. It's what happened in 12 Angry Men is not what normally happens. But a lot of it depends on the decision rule. So some juries have to be unanimous. Some juries can decide by a majority vote. How those group dynamics work in that deliberation process is very different if the verdict has to be unanimous versus majority. And a unanimous jury, they have to get everybody on board. In a majority decision rule, they can sort of take an initial vote, see how many, where everybody lies, and then they can sort of ignore the strongest jurors who the majority knows they'll never be able to convince and sort of pick off the sort of weaker links. Going back to the earlier discussion of representative juries, that is also a really important issue when it comes to jury dynamics, because we know from a lot of research, from experience, that diverse groups make better decisions in general. And what we also know from some very interesting research is that racially mixed juries deliberate better than all white juries. They discuss the evidence more thoroughly. They remember more of the evidence. They pay better attention during the trial itself. And so that can really affect the group dynamics as well.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but there's definitely still lots to discuss. Our thanks to our guests today. Leslie Ellis is a trial consultant and founder of the KYSA Group. That's a litigation consulting firm in Washington, D.C. Ron Sullivan, a professor and director of the Criminal Justice Institute at Harvard Law School. And Jeff Schwartz, a professor at Cooley Law School and a former judge with the Miami-Dade County Court. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Anna Casey. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Planet Oat. No deep thinking here. Planet Oat oat milk is rich, creamy, and an excellent source of calcium with vitamins A and D. Also, Planet Oat's unsweetened varieties have 0 grams of sugar. Visit planetoat.com for more.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.